survives in only one manuscript that was copied about 1,000 years ago. And that manuscript was damaged in the very famous Cotton Library fire in the 18th century. We nearly lost this poem. Written perhaps in the 8th century, the story is set in 6th century Scandinavia, in Denmark and Sweden and northern Germany. It's a historical epic celebrating the peoples who later came and settled in England. It's a story of warriors and monsters. There are celebrations and songs in the mead hall, and then there's violent death waiting beyond it. The narrative follows the hero Beowulf's battles against three terrible enemies, the man-shaped monster Grendel, who comes in the night, Grendel's vengeful mother, who is pursued to her underwater lair, and then finally a dragon who's been woken by a theft from its treasure hoard and comes to terrorise the country. But the genius and the depth of this poem is that its obsession with heroism and glory is completely balanced by a sense of tragedy. The battles with monsters take place against a background of constant conflicts between peoples. And of course, the whole thing is overshadowed by the ultimate struggle with time, with mortality, that's true for all of us. And while it's the earliest major English poem, it's a poem about England's history as a land of immigrants, of conflicts and alliances between competing peoples, and it's about hopes and fears. And it's, in that sense, a timeless poem about making history. And it speaks to us now as it spoke to those who heard it first. So it's a perfect poem to celebrate the BBC's centenary and the BBC's unique relationship with poets and with this poem. We've dug into the archives from the 1940s to the present using an abridged version of Seamus Heaney's translation, intercut with moments from many different adaptations, including a newly commissioned piece from Patience Agbabi. And I think this collage of modern voices and versions actually captures the spirit of the poem, which is conflict and fellowship, celebration and mourning. And it's that that makes history.
And now, great stories from the past. But as usual, a few names for the blackboard before we begin. First, Beowulf. B-E-O-W-U-L-F. Now, I wonder if any of you know what these old Anglo-Saxon storytellers were called. They were called gleemen. Glee means joy. And the gleemen were bringers of joy because people enjoyed their stories and songs. Sometimes, when I sit by the fire and think about that story of Beowulf, I seem to hear the gleeman playing his harp. I seem to hear him say,
"So."
"So."
"What?"
"Way God,
bro. Tell me we still know how to speak of kings."
"The Spear Danes in days gone by, and the kings who ruled them had courage and greatness." "There was Shield Sheafson, scourge of many tribes, a wrecker of mead benches, rampaging among foes. This terror of the hall troops had come far. A foundling to start with, he would flourish later on as his powers waxed and his worth was proved.
Yet he lived and prospered, grew in strength and stature under the heavens.
In the end, each clan on the outlying coasts beyond the Whale Road had to yield to him and begin to pay tribute. That was one good king."
"That was good kooning. He was a good king."
"Afterwards, a boy child was born to Shield. Beowulf's name was known through the north. And a young prince must be prudent like that, giving freely while his father lives, so that afterwards in age, when fighting starts, steadfast companions will stand by him and hold the line. Behavior that's admired is the path to power among people everywhere. Shield was still thriving when his time came and he crossed over into the Lord's keeping. His warrior band did what he bade them when he laid down the law among the Danes. They shouldered him out to the sea's flood, the chief they revered who had long ruled them. A ring-whorled prow rode in the harbour, ice-clad, outbound, a craft for a prince.
And this beautiful ship, what a way to go. And of course, it brings with it the notion that death is but a point of embarkation in a journey. And it must have meant so much to them. Hence the effort of bringing this massive ship, six tons at least, when light, all the way up here. And of course, this is where Beowulf comes in, because the opening movement of the poem culminates with a magnificent account of a royal ship funeral.
A boat with a ringed neck rode in the haven. And there they laid out their lord and master, giver of wound gold, in the waist of the ship, in majesty by the mast. A mound of treasures from far countries was fetched aboard her, and it is said that no boat was ever more bravely fitted out with the weapons of a warrior, war accoutrement, swords and body armor. High overhead they hoisted and fixed a gold signum, gave him to the flood, let the seas take him.
No man can tell, no wise man in hall or weathered veteran knows for certain who salvaged that load. Then it fell to Beowulf to keep the forts. He was well regarded and ruled the Danes for a long time after his father took leave of his life on earth. And then his heir, the great Halfdane, held sway. He was four times a father, this fighter prince. One by one, they entered the world. Hrothgar, Hrothgar, the good Halga, and a daughter, I have heard, who was Onela's queen. A balm in bed for the battle-scarred Swede. The fortunes of war favoured Hrothgar.
Mighty was he above all men, and greater than all people were Hrothgar's people. But Hrothgar grew old, and could no longer lead his army to battle. Therefore, said he, I will cause a mighty hall to be built, where my warriors may feast and rejoice. By the shore it shall stand, by the sea and the marshland, where all may behold it.
The Hall of Halls. Heorot was the name he had settled on it, whose utterance was law. Nor did he renege, but doled out rings and torques at the table. The hall towered, its gables wide and high, and awaiting a barbarous burning. That doom abided. But in time it would come, the killer instinct unleashed among in-laws, the bloodlust rampant. Then a powerful demon, prowler through the dark, nursed a hard grievance. It harrowed him to hear the din of the loud banquet every day in the hall, the harp being struck. Grendel was the name of this grim demon. Haunting the marches, marauding round the heath and the desolate fens.
Clywodd ellill o'r dymderau y sŵn, a gwingodd dan arteithiau ei boen. Stwyriodd o'r tywyllwch a lludio. Doedd dim gorffwys nes iddo ladd llawenydd.
So, after nightfall, Grendel set out for the lofty house to see how the ring Danes were settling into it after their drink. And there he came upon them, asleep from their feasting, insensible to pain. Suddenly then the god-cursed brute was creating havoc. Greedy and grim, he grabbed 30 men from their resting places and rushed to his lair, flushed up and inflamed from the raid, blundering back with the butchered corpses.
As the day broke with the dawn's light, Grendel's outrage was openly to be seen. Night's table laughter turned to morning's lamentation. Lord Hrothgar sat silent then. The strong man mourned. Glorious king, he grieved for his thanes. But the next night brought new horrors, did more murders, manslaughter and outrage, and shrank not from it.
Malignant by nature, he never showed remorse. Whoever escaped kept a weather eye open and moved away.
Eto, Grendel oedd yn ben.
So Grendel ruled in defiance of right, one against all, until the greatest house in the world stood empty, a deserted Wallstead. The Lord of the Shieldings suffered under his load of sorrow. And so, before long, the news was known over the whole world. Sad lays were sung about the beset king, the vicious raids and ravages of Grendel, his long and unrelenting feud, nothing but war, inflicting constant cruelties on the people, atrocious hurt. He took over Heorot, haunted the glittering hall after dark.
No warrior dared to ride. No hero from that land came forth in courage.
To the Anglo-Saxon audience, Grendel's rampage was not just a random act of terror. In attacking the Mead Hall, he was attacking society as a whole, for here the rituals were enacted which bound their society together.
So the hall is the center of not only social order, but moral order. And when the monster comes in the night and starts to tear the king's followers limb from limb, it's time for the hero.
Beowulf.
Greatest in might among men, noble and powerful was he. Beowulf was his name. He heard tell of the raids of Grendel, how for 12 years the Danes had gone in fear of him. He was minded to meet that monster, eager to conquer him in battle.
He ordered a boat that would ply the waves. He announced his plan to sail the Swan's Road and search out that king, the famous prince who needed defenders. The warrior boarded the boat as captain, a canny pilot along coast and currents. Men climbed eagerly up the gangplank. Sand churned in surf. Warriors loaded a cargo of weapons, shining war gear in the vessel's hold, then heaved out, away with a will in their wood-wreathed ship.
I groeso oer y gwyn. A hwyliodd Beowulf dros ffordd yr alarch at ei dynged yn Denmark.
Over the waves, with the wind behind her and foam at her neck, she flew like a bird until her curved prow had covered the distance. It was the end of their voyage, and the Geats vaulted over the side, out onto the sand, and moored their ship. There was a clash of mail and a thresh of gear. They thanked God for that easy crossing on a calm sea. When the watchman on the wall, the Shielding's lookout, saw shields glittering on the gangplank and battle equipment being unloaded.
The watchman feared greatly for the safety of his king. Powerfully, he brandished a huge lance, and boldly, he challenged them.
Ho there! What strangers are you? How is it that you step on the shores of Hrothgar, the mighty king, with shields in your hands and swords by your sides? Do you come then to do battle?
The leader of the troop unlocked his word hoard.
We belong by birth to the Geat people and owe allegiance to Lord Hialak. In his day, my father was a famous man, a noble warrior named Edgthiau. He outlasted many a long winter and went on his way. All over the world, men wise in council continue to remember him. We come in good faith to find your lord and nation's shield, the son of Halfdane. Give us the right advice and direction. We've arrived here on a great errand to the Lord of the Danes. And I believe, therefore, there should be nothing hidden or withheld between us. So tell us if what we have heard is true about this threat, whatever it is, this danger abroad in the dark nights, this corpse maker mongering death in the Shielding's country. I come to proffer my wholehearted help and counsel. I can show the wise Hrothgar a way to defeat his enemy and find respite. If any respite is to reach him ever, I can calm the turmoil and terror in his mind. Otherwise, he must endure woes and live with grief for as long as his hall stands at the horizon on its high ground.
And so, greatly wondering, the faithful watchman led the strangers to Heorot.
They marched in step, hurrying on till the timbered hall rose before them, radiant with gold. Nobody on earth knew of another building like it. Majesty lodged there. Its light shone over many lands.
Then the watchman sought the king, saying, O mighty lord, a band of warriors has just now come to these shores. They say they would destroy the monster Grendel. Their leader has a noble look, such as only heroes have.
Hrothgar, protector of Shieldings, replied,
Beowulf, I knew him as a child. His fame has reached me. Seafarers say, this fighting lord has 30 men in one hand's grasp. If Grendel is his name, then great reward will there be for his courage.
The hero arose, surrounded closely by his powerful thanes. Resolute in his helmet, Beowulf spoke.
Greetings to Hrothgar. I am Healak's kinsman, one of his hall troop. When I was younger, I had great triumphs. Then news of Grendel, hard to ignore, reached me at home. Sailors brought stories of the plight you suffer in this legendary hall, how it lies deserted, empty, and useless once the evening light hides itself under heaven's dome. So every elder and experienced councilman among my people supported my resolve to come here to you, King Hrothgar, because all knew of my awesome strength. And so, my request, O King of Bright Danes, dear Prince of the Shieldings, friend of the people and their ring of defense, my one request is that you won't refuse me, who have come this far, the privilege of purifying Heorot, with my own men to help me and nobody else. Hand to hand is how it will be, a life and death fight with the fiend. Whichever one death fells must deem it a just judgment by God. Fate goes ever as fate must.
And Hrothgar smiled when he saw them, so strong they seemed and shining. And when he looked upon Beowulf, his heart knew hope at last.
Hrothgar, the helmet of Shieldings, spoke. Beowulf, my friend, now take your place at the table. Relish the triumph of heroes to your heart's content. Then a bench was cleared in that banquet hall so the Geats could have room to be together. So the laughter started, the din got louder, and the crowd was happy. Wealhtheow came in, Hrothgar's queen, observing the courtesies. With measured words, she welcomed the Geat and thanked God for granting her wish that a deliverer she could believe in would arrive to ease their afflictions. Beowulf, the son of Edgetheow, declared,
I had a fixed purpose when I put out to sea. As I sat in the boat with my band of men, I meant to perform to the uttermost what your people wanted or perish in the attempt, in the fiend's clutches. And I shall fulfill that purpose, prove myself with a proud deed, or meet my death here in the mead hall.
This formal boast by Beowulf the Geat pleased the lady well, and she went to sit by Hrothgar, real and arrayed with gold. Then it was like old times in the echoing hall, proud talk and the people happy, loud and excited.
Till the son of Heofdena desired at length to leave the feast, be away to his night's rest. Aware of the monster brooding his attack on the tall gabled hall, from the time they had seen the sun's lightness to the time when darkness drowns everything, and under its shadow cover, shapes do glide dark beneath the clouds.
Hrothgar wished Beowulf health and good luck, named him Hall Warden, and announced as follows.
Never since I took up targe and sword have I handed over Heorot, as I here do, to you. Have and hold now the House of the Danes. Bend your mind and your body to this task, and wake against the foe. There'll be no want of liberality
if you come out alive from this ordeal of courage.
The Lord of the Shieldings, their shelter in war, left the mead hall to lie with Welthil, his queen and his bedmate. And before he bedded down, Beowulf, that prince of goodness, proudly asserted,
"When it comes to fighting, I count myself as dangerous any day as Grendel. So it won't be a cutting edge I'll wield to mow him down, easily as I might. He has no idea of the arts of war, of shield or sword play, though he does possess a wild strength. No weapons, therefore, for either this night. Unarmed, he shall face me, if face me he dares."
Then down the brave man lay, with his bolster under his head and his whole company of sea rovers at rest beside him. None of them expected he would ever see his homeland again, or get back to his native place and the people who reared him.
Don't forget, Anglo-Saxon England, the England of Beowulf, was a wild and underpopulated land. There were no real towns. The forests were full of wolves, and the isolated farms and settlements were little centers of human life amidst a vast, untamed nature. Their mental world was surrounded by monsters, and the unseen to them was palpable, and all was threatened to burst over the threshold into the real.
Come on, Wanre Nichte, Skriðan Shedugenga. Gliding through the shadows came the walker in the night.
Drwy'r cysgodion di peddaeth, bwystfil y nos, cysgau'r bobl. Ni allai unrhyw arf dan hael na hearn glwyfo'r bwystfil mawr anferthol.
From off the moorland's misting fells came Grendel stalking. The kerm off moor under Misliwthum, Grendel gongan.
A door di herot.
The iron-braced door turned on its hinge when his hands touched it.
Rage-inflamed, wreckage bent, he tore the hall's jaws, hastening onwards,
pacing the length of the patterned floor with his loathsome tread, while a baleful light, flame more than light, flared from his eyes, and his glee was demonic. Mighty and canny, Hayalak's kinsman was keenly watching for the first move the monster would make. Nor did the creature keep him waiting. He grabbed and mauled a man on his bench. Eaten up hand and foot. Venturing closer. His talon was raised to attack Beowulf, where he lay on the bed. He was bearing in with open claw when the alert hero's comeback and arm lock forestalled him utterly.
Hateful to each was the breath of the other. Rip in the giant flesh frame showed then.
Then an extraordinary wail arose, and bewildering fear came over the Danes. A god-cursed scream and strain of catastrophe. The howl of the loser.
Shoulder muscles sprang apart. A snapping of tendons. Bone locks burst.
A breach in the giant flesh frame showed then. To Beowulf the glory of this fight was granted. Grendel's lot to flee the slopes fenward with flagging heart. To a den where he knew there could be no relief, no refuge for a life at its very last stage, whose surrender day had dawned.
Beowulf had cleansed Heorot, saved the whole from persecution, and as a signal to all, the hero hung the hand, the arm and torn off shoulder, the entire limb, Grendel's whole grip, beneath the soaring roof.
All gazed with joy and wonder at the arm of Grendel, its fingers stretched up to the high roof. Where the nails should be were claws of steel, cruel spikes. Men shuddered as they looked on it.
Then morning came, and many a warrior gathered, wondering greatly at the monster's footprints. Where he'd skulked away, exhausted in spirit and beaten in battle, bloodying the path, hauling his doom to the demon's mere. The bloodshot water wallowed and surged. There were loathsome upthrows and overturnings of waves and gore and wound slurry.
He had dived to his doom. He had died miserably. Here in his fen lair, he had laid aside his heathen soul. Hell welcomed it.
The light of day broke and kept brightening. Bands of retainers galloped in excitement to the gabled hall to see the marvel. When Hrothgar arrived at the hall, he spoke.
May the gods be thanked for you, Beowulf. The deed that you have done this night makes you mighty above all heroes. Often have I rewarded lesser deeds with great gifts. To you, I can deny nothing. Hail to you, Beowulf.
We have gone through with a glorious endeavour and been much favoured in this fight we dared against the unknown. Nevertheless, if you could have seen the monster himself, where he lay beaten, I would have been better pleased. My plan was to pounce, pin him down in a tight grip and grapple him to death, have him panting for life, powerless and clasped in my bare hands, his body in thrall. But I couldn't stop him from slipping my hold. The Lord allowed it. My lock on him wasn't strong enough. He struggled fiercely and broke and ran. Yet he bought his freedom at a high price, for he left his hand and arm and shoulder to show he'd been here, a cold comfort for having come among us. And now he won't be long for this world. He's done his worst, but the wound will end him. He is hasped and hooped and harpling with pain, limping and looped in it, like a man outlawed for wickedness. He must await the mighty judgment of God in majesty.
Then Halfdane's son presented Beowulf with a gold standard as a victory gift, an embroidered banner, also breastmail and a helmet, and a sword carried high that was both precious object and token of honor.
Come now to a banquet. We'll celebrate with song, old tales of victory.
So Beowulf drank his drink at ease. It was hardly a shame to be showered with such gifts in front of the hall troops. They sang then and played to please the hero. Words and music for their warrior prince, harp tunes and tales of adventure. There were high times on the hall benches, and the king's poet performed his part with the saga of Finn and his sons, unfolding the tale of that fierce attack in Friesland, when Hnaf, king of the Danes, met death, and his sister Hildebur suffered cruelly. Son and brother, she lost them both on the battlefield. They foredoomed, cut down and spear-gored. She in shock, waylaid by grief, Hawk's daughter. How could she not lament her fate when morning came and the light broke on her murdered dears? So a truce was offered as follows. First, separate quarters to be cleared for the Danes, hall and throne to be shared with the Frisians. With oaths to Hengist, Finn swore openly, solemnly, that the battle survivors would be guaranteed honor and status. No infringement by word or deed, no provocation would be permitted. Their own ring giver was dead and gone. They were leaderless, in forced allegiance to his murderer. A funeral pyre was then prepared, effulgent gold brought out from the hoard. The pride and prince of the Shieldings lay awaiting the flame. Then Hildebur ordered her own son's body to be burnt with Hnaf's, the flesh on his bones to sputter and blaze beside his uncle's. The woman wailed and sang keens. The warrior went up. Carcass flame swirled and fumed. They stood round the burial mound and howled as heads melted. crusted gashes spattered and ran bloody matter. Warriors scattered to homes and forts all over Friesland. Hengist stayed, lived out that whole resentful, blood-sullen winter with Finn, homesick and helpless. Then winter was gone. Earth's lap grew lovely. Longing woke in the cooped-up exile for a voyage home, but more for vengeance, some way of bringing things to a head. His sword arm hankered to greet the Dutes. Thus blood was spilled, the gallant Finn slain in his home. The wildness in them had to brim over. The hall ran red with blood of enemies. Finn was cut down, the queen brought away, and everything the Scyldings could find inside Finn's walls, the Frisian king's gold collars and gemstones, swept off to the ship. Over sea lanes then, back to Daneland, the warrior troop bore that lady home. The poem was over. The poet had performed. A pleasant murmur started on the benches. Stewards did the rounds with wine and splendid jugs. The queen spoke to Hrothgar.
Heorot is cleansed. The ring hall bright again.
So, give while you may, generous lord, great rewards.
She turned then to the bench where her boys sat, all the youth together. And that good man, Beowulf the Geat, sat between the brothers. The cup was carried to him, kind words spoken in welcome, and a wealth of gold given to the hero. Two arm bangles, a mail shirt and rings, and the most resplendent torque of gold I ever heard tell of anywhere on earth or under heaven. Then the queen pronounced in the presence of the company.
Cymer di a gem harth hwn, fanwyl Beowulf.
Take joy in this fair jewel, dear Beowulf.
Men were drinking wine at that rare feast. How could they know fate, the grim shape of things to come?
Then it became known to all men, another deadly foe, dark spirit, survived within those foul depths, a loathsome creature living to avenge.
The threat looming over many thanes as night approached and King Hrothgar prepared to retire to his quarters.
Sef mam, Grendel. Bwystfil yn galaru am ei mab marw.
Grendel's mother, a she-monster, grieving for her dead son.
Monstrous hell bride, brooded on her wrongs.
She sought her recompense.
She had been forced down into fearful waters, the cold depths, but now sallied forth on a savage journey.
She descended on Heorot, and fate swept on its wheel when the mother of Grendel found her way among those men. She grasped a man quickly, the king's good friend, Asherah, clutched him to herself and was away to the fen. Beowulf was not there. Heorot was in uproar. Grendel's hand had gone with her.
And the old lord, the grey-haired warrior, was heart sore and weary when he heard the news. His highest placed advisor, his dearest companion, was dead and gone.
Beowulf was soon summoned to the chamber, victory-blessed man. And that valiant warrior came with his following, it was at first light, captain of his company, to where the king waited to see if by some means the swayer of all would work a turning into this tale of sorrow. The man, excellent in warfare, walked across the hall, flanked by his escort. The floor timbers boomed to make his addresses to the Danish lord.
Asherah is lost, lifted from his bed. My wisest friend, when the robber Grendel roamed at will, gorging on my men, some glimpsed another. Not one, but two dark wanderers wending through the mists. And one in woman's shape.
A few miles from here, a frost-stiffened wood waits and keeps watch above a mere. At night there, something uncanny happens. The water burns, and the mere bottom has never been sounded by the sons of men. Now help depends again on you, and on you alone. The gap of danger where the demon waits is still unknown to you. Seek it if you dare. Beowulf, the son of Edgethil, spoke.
Why, sir, do not grieve. It is always better to avenge dear ones than to indulge in mourning.
It is always better to avenge dear ones than to indulge in mourning.
For every one of us, living in this world
means waiting for our end.
Let whoever can win glory before death.
Glory before death.
When a warrior is gone, that will be his best and only bulwark. So arise, my lord, and let us immediately set forth on the trail of this troll dam. I guarantee you she will not get away. Not to dens underground, nor upland groves, nor the ocean floor. She'll have nowhere to flee to. Endure your troubles today. Bear up and be the man I expect you to be.
With that, the old lord sprang to his feet and praised God for Beowulf's pledge. The wise king mounted the royal saddle and rode out in style with a force of shield-bearers. Up fells and screes, along narrow footpaths and ways where they were forced into single file, and suddenly discovered the dismal wood. The bloodshot water surged underneath.
Bitter distress was to be endured by the Danes who were there, a grief for the earls, for every thane of the friends of the Scyldings, when they found there the head of Asherah by the edge of the cliff.
The next eruption from the demonic, chthonic, watery depths of the mere was, to the early medieval mind, and maybe to ours still too, even more threatening because it was female.
Everybody gazed as the hot gore kept wallowing up and an urgent war horn repeated its notes. The water was infested. There were writhing sea dragons and monsters slouching on slopes by the cliff. Serpents and wild things, down they plunged, lashing in anger at the loud call of the battle bugle.
Grendel's mother may be fearsome, but she still feels a mother's bond to her child. And to the poet, that's even a source of imaginative sympathy. It makes her more than just a scary monster. She's a perverse mirror to mankind.
The Geat put on the armor of a hero, unanxious for his life. The manufacture of the mailed shirt, figured and vast, that must venture in the deep, made it such a bulwark to his bone-framed chest that the savage attack of an incensed enemy could do no harm to the heart within it. His head was encircled by a silver helmet that was to strike down through the swirl of water, disturb the depths. Adorned with treasure, clasped with royal bands, it was right as at first when the weaponsmith had wonderfully made it, so that no sword should afterward be able to cut through the defending wild boars that faced about it.
And another item, lent by Unferth, a rare and ancient sword named Hrunting. The iron blade with its ill-boding patterns had been tempered in blood. It had never failed the hand of anyone who hefted it in battle.
The Anglo-Saxons believed in the reality of supernatural forces that could only be defeated by magic, whether by the cross of the saintly exorcist or by the sword of the hero.
Beowulf, son of Edgethil, spoke.
Wisest of kings, now that I have come to the point of action, I ask you to recall what we said earlier. That you, son of Halfdane and gold friend to retainers, that you, if I should fall and suffer death while serving your cause, would act like a father to me afterwards. If this combat kills me, take care of my young company, my comrades in arms, and be sure also, my beloved Hrothgar, to send Healak the treasures I received. Let the Lord of the Geats gaze on that gold. Let Hrethel's son take note of it and see that I found a ring giver of rare magnificence and enjoyed the good of his generosity. An unferth is to have what I inherited. To that far-famed man I bequeath my own sharp-horned, wave-sheened wonder blade. With hunting, I shall gain glory or die.
Without further ado, he dived into the heaving depths of the lake. It was the best part of a day before he could see the solid bottom.
Grim and greedy, the guardian of the waters had kept a 100 winters watch.
The hero observed that swamp thing from hell, the Tarnhag, in all her terrible strength, then heaved his war sword and swung his arm. The decorated blade came down ringing and singing on her head. But he soon found the shining blade refused to bite. The fabulous powers of that heirloom failed. He would have to rely on the might of his arm.
A man must act so when he means in a fight to frame himself a long-lasting glory. It is not life he thinks of. The Geat prince went for Grendel's mother, seized her by the shoulder. He was not sorry to be fighting his mortal foe. And with mounting anger, the man, hard in battle, hurled her to the ground. She promptly repaid this present of his as her ruthless hands reached out for him. And the strongest of fighting men stumbled in his weariness. The firmest of foot warriors fell to the earth. She was down on this guest of hers and had drawn her knife, broad, burnished of edge, for her boy was to be avenged, her only son. Overspreading his back, the shirt of mail shielded his life then, barred the entry to edge and point. Edgetheow's son would have ended his venture deep underground there, the Geat fighter, had not the battle shirt then brought him aid, his war shirt of steel. The ruler of the heavens rightly settled it as soon as the Geat regained his feet.
Then he saw, among the armor on the wall, a giant sword from former days. This wonder was so enormous that no other man would be equal to bearing it in battle play. Well, it was a giant's forge that had fashioned it so well. The Geat champion, shaking now with war rage, caught it by the rich hilt, and careless of his life, brandished its circles and brought it down in fury to catch her full and fairly, biting into the neck. The blade sheared through the backbone. The sword was gory. He was glad at the deed.
The seafarer's leader made for land, resolutely swimming, delighted with his prize. His thanes advanced in a troop to meet him, thanking God and taking great delight in seeing their prince back safe and sound. With high hearts, they headed away along footpaths and trails through the fields. It was a task for four to hoist Grendel's head on a spear and bear it under a strain to the bright hall. Beowulf, son of Edgetheow, spoke.
So, son of Halfdane, Prince of the Shieldings, we are glad to bring this booty from the lake. It is a token of triumph, and we tender it to you. I barely survived the battle underwater. It was hard fought, a desperate affair that could have gone badly. If God had not helped me, the outcome would have been quick and fatal. I have wrested the hilt from the enemy's hand, avenged the evil done to the Danes. It is what was due, and this I pledge. O Prince of the Shieldings, you can sleep secure with your company of troops in here at Hall. Never need you fear for a single thane of your sept or nation, young warriors or old, that laying waste of life that you and your people endured of yore.
Then the golden hilt was handed over to the old lord, a relic from long ago for the venerable ruler.
Then Halfdane's son presented Beowulf with a gold standard as a victory gift, an embroidered banner, also breastmail and a helmet and a sword carried high that was both precious object and token of honor.
And soon all was restored, the same as before. Happiness came back, the hall was thronged, and a banquet set forth. Black night fell and covered them in darkness. Then the company rose for the old campaigner. The gray-haired prince was ready for bed. and a need for rest came over the brave shield-bearing Geat. The hall towered, gold-shingled and gabled, and the guests slept in it until the black raven, with raucous glee, announced heaven's joy, and a hurry of brightness overran the shadows. Warriors rose quickly, impatient to be off. The undaunted hero addressed Hrothgar.
Now we who crossed the wide sea have to inform you that we feel a desire to return to Hialak. Here we have been welcomed and thoroughly entertained. You have treated us well. If there is any favor on earth I can perform beyond deeds of arms I have done already, anything that would merit your affections more, I shall act my lord with alacrity. If ever I hear from across the ocean that people on your borders are threatening battle, as attackers have done from time to time, I shall land with 1,000 thanes at my back to help your cause. Hialak may be young to rule a nation, but this much I know about the King of the Geats. He will come to my aid and want to support me by word and action in your hour of need, when honor dictates that I raise a hedge of spears around you.
Vathurin gan haliodd gyfiawnder a gwirionedd yn y tir, ac sy'n frenin ers cyn cof yn wir ddweud hyn. Fe ganwyd e I fod yn orau un. Ein hanwyl Beowulf.
The one who upholds justice and truth in the land, ruling as long as many can remember, may indeed say this. He was born to be the best of men, most dear Beowulf.
And so the good and grey-haired Dane, that high-born king, kissed Beowulf and embraced his neck, then broke down in sudden tears. The embrace ended, and Beowulf, glorious in his gold regalia, stepped the green earth. Straining at anchor and ready for boarding, his boat awaited him. Sail ropes were tightened, timbers drummed, and stiff winds kept the wave crosser skimming ahead. As she heaved forward, her foamy neck was fleet and buoyant, a lapped prow loping over currents.
Hwyliodd y llong gan dorri trwy'r dŵr a gadael tir Denmark.
Swift sailed the boat, dividing the waves, left the land of Denmark, returned to Hugalak's kingdom.
Beowulf's return was reported to Hialak as soon as possible. News that the captain was now in the enclosure. His battle brother, back from the fray, alive and well, walking to the hall. Room was quickly made on the king's orders, and the troops filed across the cleared floor. He hankered to know every tale the sea geats had to tell. He had been poorly regarded for a long time, was taken by the geats for less than he was worth. They firmly believed that he lacked force, that the prince was a weakling. But presently, every affront to his deserving was reversed.
Fa nwylaf Beowulf, rydw I yn rhoi I ti ystad o 7,000 o wartheg, yr orsedd hon a neuad, yr orain y tir, yn haiddi clod cyfran deilwng o iarll.
I bestow on you an estate of 7,000 cattle, this princely throne, and a hall greatest in the land, gloriously decked, worthy of praise, the portion of an earl.
A lot was to happen in later days. In the fury of battle, Hialak fell, and the shelter of Heardred's shield proved useless against the fierce aggression of the Scylfings. The wide kingdom reverted to Beowulf. He ruled it well for 50 winters, grew old and wise as warden of the land.
Fifty winters of north wind, a smorgasbord of words for snow, shackled ice, stalactite, stalagmite, Beowulf ruled his wide realm. Beard wintered with wisdom, bone cage large with gravitas, our hero held his homeland till, one dark and star-struck night, where the earth surges up, up, grassing and greenscaping a steep stone bouldered barrow, burial ground. A dragon stirred. Guardian of glistening, glamorous gold, as yellow as black gold, crude oil extracted from earth and murky sea, is black. And jewels, winking wealth, as mirabled, multifaceted, as dragon is extravagantly green. What use have the dead for precious gems? What use has a beast for a treasure chest? Except the glamour, the glimmer, the glow that lights the gloom of the hollow cave. Dragon guarded the treasure trove of a long-lost tribe, as dragons, masculine, feminine, and neuter, protect their progeny from predators. When someone on the run stumbled across the den and accidentally on purpose purloined a jeweled cup, since money manacles man's mindscape, then, sensing evil, fled in terror, the green minder of Mother Earth, fauna and flora, flared up. Do not disturb the habitat of the wordworm, the wild one, for when a dumb beast speaks, they speak the sparkiest sibilance, spit a split-tongued truth. Let sleeping dragons lie. 300 winters of white words, dragonhood ruled their ring hoard till the thief disturbed the treasure trove and made haste to inform his master, his lord, who ordered the den be looted, the gleam of greed in his eyes, and a pardon granted the absconder who reaped the worst with that first theft. When dragon stirred, life stood still. The serpent sensed Homo sapiens, scanned the thief's physical footprint, evidence the enemy had entered. The horde guardian scoured the ground, inside and outside, over and under, desperate to discover the intruder. Flesh famished and bloodthirsty, encircled the cave to catch the coward, but nothing, no one. Back in the barrow, hollow and dark as a howl, sought the gold cup, discovered it, gone. The sun was slow to sink on the sea, and with each hour, the heat heightened, every second incendiary, until darkness fell, and the fire of rage boiled in the breast of the barrow beast. For the theft of a cup, revenge erupted. Dragon took off in a frenzy of flames, scarring their name on the panorama. Terror gripped the earthscape. Grief engulfed the heart of the Geats. So begins the end of the son of Edsthael, the brave, unassailable Beowulf. The fire spitter spewed a word horde, inflammatory invocation, hated, heated, and hunted, burning the burnished buildings and punishing the populace. Here, there, dragon waged war. But before the East Orb opened its eye, they retreated to the banked barrow, the dark den of death, lit by the glittering, glistening jewels they guarded like golden eggs. Then Beowulf heard the murmurs. No smoke without fire rumours. His own home, high throne, haven, hearth of Hugga, safe space. Say it, though the truth thickens your throat, had blazed in waves of flames. Fire dragon gone on the rampage or the ramparts. It hit home in his heartbeat. Was it weird? What must be? What had he done to earn the sentence of God, the great creator? Beowulf, not himself, shipwrecked by self-doubt, doom-ravaged, declared revenge. The leader of the Geats ordered a war shield fashioned from iron, impervious to fire, as woods from the woods would smoulder, combust. Time and weird were winding thin for the proud protector of the populace and the serpent, though he'd shielded his hoard 300 hibernations. Beowulf, the Prince of Rings, resisted charging the dragon with a large army. He was not afraid of the Fire Flayer, our protagonist, who'd done in, finished men, Grendel and Grendel's mother, the human, the superhuman. He'd battled, attacked and ransacked, witnessed grief, loss of life every which way, yet remained brave. Today, he would face his ultimate fate. Weird, in the form of the Wordworm, his nemesis, the Serpent. Beowulf took just 12 men on his final fight with the Firespitter, including the culprit who'd plundered the cup, spurring the dragon's extravagant wrath. This 13th man, this unlucky thief, was afraid to revisit the dragon's den. But only he knew the secluded route to the underground den, the stone hall near the crashing, thrashing saltscape. Take a glimpse at the gleaming gems, the showy stones, the treasure trove. You'll need guts to try to retrieve them. Beowulf the king, ring-giver of the Geats, seated on the cape with a heavy care, wished his hearthmen good health and heart, hid his low mood, impending doom drawing nearer and nearer to our hero. Soon his body and soul would fork, his lifespan end, his life spirit take wing from his bone bondage. As images flitted from his former life, 7 years old, fostered by Threthel in the royal court, in awe of his kinship, the glitter of gems, the fire of feasts. An arrow pierced in Herebeald's chest, freak accident, brother killed brother. War between Swedes and Geats. The shining sword and precious treasure honoured to him by Hialak. Beowulf, son of Edsthael, said,
"With the blade's edge, this tested weapon, this named slayer Naegling, his hard sword, I'll recover the treasure. When I was young, I fought tough and survived. Now I am old, I'll prove bolder, conquer this dragon fiend, for the glory of God, if it dares to surface, face me in combat. With simple chain mail, shield and sword, no boyish boasts or wise words, I'll face my rival. This is no knuckle fight with Grendel or his vengeful virago. This is a fight against fire. I will not shift a foot. I will trust that fate, weird divine will, must decide who'll win. Wait here on the barrow, safe in your war gear, to see which of us bears our wounds best. Who gives in first? Who holds out last? It's my rite of passage, my battle alone. Either gleaming gold or grimacing death."
From the dragon's den, a stream rippled with flickering flames from the dragon's breath. Who could confront that heat? Behold Beowulf, wizened warrior, greying with greatness, king of the Geats. Hero in armour and shimmering shield, revealing the gleaming edge of his sword, the ancient heirloom named Naegling. He let one word burst from his core. A battle cry that boomed in the barrow, ricocheted off the grey stone cave. And his nemesis, the antagonist, fire starter, flame spitter, eco-hero, echoed back an earth-shattering, earth-dragon roar of flame, smoke and steam. Snaked out of the cave, uncoiled, 50 foot long, scaled and scalding, gold guardian, glittering, green. Behold the beauty of the beast. Horrified, they mirrored each other. Then the creature coiled and collided with Beowulf's shield. It held out, but not as long as he longed for it, and when he raised his hand to attack his fierce and fiery nemesis, the cutting edge of the legendary sword failed on the bony scales. Played the wrong tune for a warrior in the heat of battle. The barrow beast, incensed and incendiary, spat back a barrage of battle bites, and the son of Edsthael took umbrage, but sprang back, gave ground against his will, as we must all one day concede the final defeat. But the fight is not over yet. These two enemies, twinned by fate, clashed once more. The Wordworm took a deep breath, spewed a firestorm, and Beowulf was trapped in a ring of fire, he who had once freed his people. His men, armoured, weaponed and trained, did not advance, brave and warlike, to save their lord. They fled to the forest to save their own skin. Except for one, known as Wiglaf, son of Weirstan. He couldn't desert his worthy lord, remembering the rings and rewards brave Beowulf had bestowed upon him. His hand grasping his shield and sword, Wiglaf cursed his cowardly companions. Remember the promises we made in the beer hall to Beowulf, how we pledged allegiance for this bloodshed. And though he swore on his ancient sword to go it alone, I would rather allow the flames to burn my bulky body to ashes alongside my lavish lord than desert him now. With that, he hurried through the seething fumes to meet his leader with these words, "Lord, I will support you." Hearing those words, the word worm exploded with expletives. The fire flames swelled in waves and charred Wiglaf's shield to a cinder. His metal armor would not save him. Only his king's shield conserved him. But now, recalling his past advantage, his legendary epic strength, Beowulf wielded his battle blade with such power, it stuck in the skull of the winged one. Naegling shattered. Such was Beowulf's brute force, too superhuman for sword or shield. Then, for the third and final time, the Firestarter, feeling his life force threatened, lunged towards Beowulf, fierce and bloodthirsty, bit him in the neck with his bitter jaws. Beowulf bled, mortally wounded. His lifeblood flowed like lava. But Wiglaf remained brave and faithful, although his battling hand was burned. With his sword, studded and bloodstained, he struck at the dragon, lower down, and the fire began to beat back. Then Beowulf, bloody, brave and bright-eyed, saw in that split second a lifeline. He drew the sharp knife he wore in his armor and plunged it into the dragon's gut. The fatal thrust that snuffed out the flame spitter, and they fell. Extinguished. Earthed. Extinct. These two men together, twinned warriors, had finally brought the dragon down. Wiglaf honored the 11th hour. But for Beowulf, it was his final win. His fate, his weird, his fatal wound mirrored the doom of the Wordworm.
So, daring drove out life. Fech Elin Rek.
Then the wound dealt by the ground burner earlier began to scald and swell. Beowulf discovered deadly poison suppurating inside him, surges of nausea.
And the king saw the last triumph of his works in the world. Wiglaf took water and washed his good lord, bathed away battle blood, loosened his helmet.
Beowulf spoke. In spite of his wounds, for he well knew his days in the world had been lived out to the end, his allotted time was drawing to a close. Death was very near.
Now is the time when I would have wanted to bestow this armor on my own son, had it been my fortune to have fathered an heir and live on in his flesh. For 50 years I ruled this nation. No king of any neighboring clan would dare face me with troops. None had the power to intimidate me. I stood my ground and took what came, cared for things in my keeping, never fomented quarrels, never swore to a lie. All this consoles me.
Go now, quickly, dearest Wiglaf. Under the grey stone where the dragon is laid out, lost his treasure, hurry to feast your eyes on the hoard. Away you go. I want to examine the ancient gold, gaze my fill on those garnered jewels. My going will be easier for having seen the treasure, less troubled letting go of the life and lordship I have long maintained.
Straight away, as I have heard, the son of Weokstan obeyed his wounded lord, weak from the struggle. Following these words, he went in his ring coat, his broidered battle tunic, under the barrow's roof. Traversing the ledge to the treasure house of jewels, the valiant young thane was thrilled by the sight of the gold gleaming on the ground where it lay. The devices along the wall and the den of the serpent winger of the darkness. Drinking cups stood there, the unburnished vessels of a vanished race, their ornaments awry.
Rusty helmets all eaten away, armbands everywhere, artfully wrought. How easily treasure buried in the ground, gold hidden however skillfully, can escape from any man. Wiglaf went quickly, keen to get back. He was hoping he would find the leader of the Geats alive, for he had left him, helpless, earlier, on the open ground. So he came to the place, carrying the treasure, and found his lord bleeding profusely, his life at an end. The old lord gazed sadly at the gold.
To the everlasting lord of all, to the king of glory, I give thanks that I behold this treasure here in front of me, that I have been allowed to leave my people so well endowed on the day I die. Now that I've bartered my last breath to own this fortune, it is up to you to look after their needs. I can hold out no longer. Order my troop to construct a barrow on a headland on the coast after my pyre is cooled, so that in coming times crews under sail will call it Beowulf's Barrow as they steer ships across the wide and shrouded waters.
The Anglo-Saxons had a vivid sense of living in an old landscape, with prehistoric long barrows and standing stones all around them.
The great stone circles to their poets were the work of giants, wondrous work of wall stones, and the ancient Stone Age burial mounds were heathen burials, places where the ancestral treasures were stored up and guarded by dragons.
Then the king, in his great heartedness, unclasped the collar of gold from his neck and gave it to his young thane, telling him to use it and the war shirt and the gilded helmet.
You're the last of us, the only one left of the Wigmundings. Fate swept us away, sent my whole brave highborn clan to their final doom. Now I must follow.
That was the warrior's last word.
That was the warrior's last word. He had no more to confide.
His soul fled from his breast to its destined place among the steadfast ones. It was hard then on the young hero, having to watch the one he held so dear there on the ground, going through his death agony. The dragon from under earth, his nightmarish destroyer, lay destroyed as well. Never again would he glitter and glide and show himself off in the midnight air, exulting in his riches. He fell to earth through the battle strength in Beowulf's arm. The treasure had been won, bought and paid for by Beowulf's death. Both had reached the end of the road through the life they had been lent.
It was not long then till they budged from the wood, the battle shirkers, 10 of them together, those traitors and weaklings who had not dared deploy their spears in their own lord's extreme need. They bore their shields ashamedly, their armor of war, to where the old man lay. They regarded Wiglaf. Warily he sat, a good soldier, at the shoulder of his lord. Wiglaf spoke, Weokstan's offspring.
Beowulf had little cause to brag about his armed guard, yet I found new strength welling up when I went to help him. Then my sword connected, and the deadly assaults of our foe grew weaker, the fire coursed less strongly from his head. But when the worst happened, too few rallied around the prince. So it is goodbye now to all you know and love on your home ground, the open-handedness, the giving of war swords. Our whole nation will be dispossessed once princes from beyond get tidings of how you turned and fled and disgraced yourselves. A warrior will die sooner than live a life of shame.
He bade that the combat's result be proclaimed in the city over the brow of the headland.
Now the people's pride and love, the Lord of the Geats, is laid on his deathbed, brought down by the dragon's attack. Now war is looming over our nation. Soon it will be known to Franks and Frisians, far and wide, that the king is gone. Nor do I expect peace or pact-keeping of any sort from the Swedes. This vicious feud, I am convinced, is bound to revive. They will cross our borders and attack in force when they find out that Beowulf is dead. His royal pyre will melt no small amount of gold. Heaped there in a hoard, it was bought at heavy cost. And that pile of rings he paid for at the end with his own life will go up with the flame, be furled in fire. Treasure no follower will wear in his memory.
The war band arose. They went unhappily under Eärnenes to look on the wonder with welling tears. They found him on the sand, his soul fled, keeping his resting place. Rings he had given them in former times. But the final day had come for the champion, and the chief of the Geats, the warrior king, had met his wondrous death. Stranger the creature they encountered first in the level place, the loathsome worm stretched out opposite. Scorched by its own flames lay the fire drake in its fatal markings, and it measured 50 feet as it lay. He had once been master of the midnight air, held sweet sway there, and swooped down again to seek his den. Standing by him, there were bowls and flagons, there were platters lying there, and precious swords quite rusted through, as they had rested there 1,000 winters in the womb of earth. Wiglaf spoke, Weokstan's son.
Often when one man follows his own will, many are hurt. This happened to us. Nothing we advised could ever convince the lord we loved, our land's guardian, not to aggravate the keeper of the gold. Let him lie where he was long accustomed, lurk there under earth until the end of the world. He held to his high destiny. The hoard is laid bare, but at a grave cost. It was too cruel a fate. Then Weostan's son, stalwart to the end, had orders given to owners of dwellings to fetch wood from far and wide for the good man's pyre. They pitched the dragon over the cliff top, let tides flow and backwash take the treasure minder.
It's a miracle it survived. Like all of Anglo-Saxon poetry, it's astonishing to think that the very root of our literary heritage only just got through. The faded ink, the singed vellum, the crumbling margins, carrying the word hoard down to us. And the poem itself ends in flames, with Beowulf's body taken to a headland by the sea, in his Geat kingdom.
The Geat race then raised up a funeral pyre. Shining mail and shields of war and helmets hung upon it.
They laid out in the middle the body of their chief, and on top there then kindled the biggest funeral fire. The roaring of flames mingled with weeping as the fire's red heart consumed the house of bone. Heaven swallowed the smoke.
Beowulf is dead, gone down. Time tells his tale. Fever fought those favors, Lord of Fire. Rise, winter wind, Beowulf burns.
Beowulf burns. The hero's boiled blood flows free from mountain peak to sea foam.
He is free forever.
His fame lives forever.
The great worm killed our king. The Black Hill burns his bones to dust.
Then the Geat people began to construct a mound on a headland, high and imposing, a marker that sailors could see from far away. It was their hero's memorial, as worthy of him as their workmanship could make it. And they buried torques in the barrow, and jewels, and a trove of such things as trespassing men had once dared to drag from the hoard.
The beacon to that battle-reckless man they made in 10 days. What remained from the fire, they cast a wall around, of workmanship as fine as their wisest men could frame for it.
They let the ground keep that ancestral treasure, gold under gravel, gone to earth, as useless to men now as it ever was. Then 12 warriors rode around the tomb, chieftains' sons, champions in battle, all of them distraught, chanting in dirges, mourning his loss, as a man and a king. They extolled his heroic nature and exploits and gave thanks for his greatness, which was the proper thing, for a man should praise a prince whom he holds dear and cherish his memory.
All men praised the name of Beowulf. And throughout many countries, gleemen told tales of him, even as I have told this tale to you.
Can dweud mai o holl frenhinoedd byd, ef oedd y mwynaf garedicaf un, yn gyfaill i'w bobl, un a enillodd glod.
They said he had proved, of all kings in the world, the gentlest of men. The most gracious.
Kindest to his people and keenest to win fame.
That is the end of today's story about Beowulf.
Sandy Grierson played Beowulf in Seamus Heaney's translation, abridged by Professor Laura Ash at the University of Oxford. The dragon poem was written and performed by Patience Egbuabi. Actors featured in the archive include Julian Glover in his own adaptation, Derek Jacobi, Timothy West, Frank Lincoln, Rhys Parry-Jones, John Owen, Hazel Wynne Williams, John Castle, Anna Calder-Marshall, Harvey Hallsmith and Carlton Hobbs, with contributions from poet Maria Devana Headley and presenter Michael Woods. The Beowulf song was composed and performed by Cheryl Francis Hoad. Beowulf Retold was a BBC Audio Drama North production produced by Pauline Harris.
This is Ultimate Calm with me, Oliver Arnolds.
Escape with the Icelandic composer for an hour-long haven of peace and serenity.
Ultimate Calm is a 12-episode series, each one a little journey into calmness, inspired by a different theme.
With music reflecting nature, the seasons and the sea.
Letting ourselves float away on an ocean of calm.
Ultimate Calm with Olafur Arnolds on on Mondays at 9 p.m. on Radio 3, or listen to more episodes on BBC Sounds.
It's 9:05, and time now on Radio 3 to join Hannah French for her weekly listen to some of the best new recordings in classical music.
Thanks, and welcome to Record Review Extra. Let Rossini sweep you away with some operatic vibes in church.